day tonight. The forecast from the National Weather Service. The wind chill advisory continues until tomorrow morning. Today, sunny, windy, and bitterly cold. A high of 1 above. Winds 10 to 20 miles per hour. Wind chills 23 to 33 below zero. Right now, it's minus 6 in Racine and Kenosha. Wind west at 18. Wind chill minus 21. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I dare say that most Americans, and I count myself among the Americans, who do not spend sufficient time and energy and attention to the U.S. Supreme Court and to the very important role that they play in American life and society. And Supreme Court decisions can have a monumental effect on all of our lives. And of course, at certain occasions, we hear a great deal about the U.S. Supreme Court, but I think most of us have a very limited awareness of how the Supreme Court does what it does, sort of its day-to-day function, the way in which its calendar of activity and obligation is put together. And of course, what goes into the decisions that ultimately are rendered by the highest court in the land. We're going to be exploring some of that and more with Pat Subkowski, who teaches at Marquette University and also serves as a pre-law advisor at their College of Arts and Sciences. And one of the things that Pat Subkowski has devoted a great deal of energy to in his academic life and research is the United States Supreme Court and the whole matter of the balance of powers between the three branches of government and how the Supreme Court has functioned in the past and how it is functioning at the present. And there's a whole lot for us to cover and explore, and I'm excited about the next few minutes. Pat Subkowski, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg. It's pleasure to be here. I'm looking forward to the conversation.
I would love to know right off the bat a little bit about what brought you into the whole arena of law. And at the time that you entered and went to law school and so on, what your aspirations were? Were they to do what you are doing now? Or at the outset, did you have other plans in terms of what you would do in the legal field?
Well, that's a great question. I grew up around, my father was an attorney. He practiced for 40 years. He is now retired, and quite enjoying the retirement, as I'm sure many people would imagine. But when I went to law school, well, let me back up first. My advisor when I was at Carthage was John Leeser, who's a professor in the history department. And when it came time for me to decide what I wanted to do, I went to his office and I asked him, okay, I am in between two different options here. The first is go and pursue a history PhD. The second is to go to law school. And without hesitation, he told me go to law school because of the practical opportunities that law school presents as opposed to obtaining a PhD in history. So I went to law school. I knew that I would be happy there, given, you know, growing up talking with my dad and knowing some of his colleagues at where he worked. But very quickly, when I got to law school, especially after taking constitutional law, I realized that I wanted to pursue academia. And that was really kind of what the rest of my career in law school was aimed at. So it's sort of nice to see that that's paid dividends fairly early on in my career. So
great. What kinds of things are you teaching at Marquette University?
So I teach our constitutional law courses in the political science department. So those are that's split into two classes. You cannot possibly cover everything that you need to cover in a single con law course. So I teach con law one, which is focused on structures of government. So the separation of powers and federalism, the division of authority between the federal government and the state governments. And then on the second part of the con law sequence is civil rights and civil liberties. So the issues that make the front page of the New York Times, right? So abortion, affirmative action, free speech, searches and seizures, the relationship between citizens and law enforcement, those types of issues. I also teach a courts and public policy course, which is aimed at really getting students to understand, first off, how the legal system in the United States operates, what's unique and what's not so unique about it, and perhaps the even bigger picture is seeing how the courts, specifically the federal courts, have come to be so instrumental in the creation, development, and implementation of public policy writ large. And then this semester, I am teaching a course that is a seminar-style course on the American administrative state. There's a lot there. The administrative state, administrative law is where my scholarship really lies at its heart. So those are the ones I've taught thus far. My anticipation is that will continue and broaden as my time at Marquette continues.
Excellent. So the primary focus of our conversation today is the United States Supreme Court. And at the outset, I said something that I suspect you would agree with, namely that most Americans only are aware of the U.S. Supreme Court when it makes headlines, as of course it does from time to time. But most of us have very little understanding of kind of the year-round workings of the Supreme Court, how it operates, and sort of what's going on between those mostly closed doors. And eventually we're going to look at some of their most significant cases in the recent past and what they are going to be confronting in the near future. But I would love to begin with, if we could, with sort of a summary from you of what the U.S. Supreme Court does and how they do it. And one of the things that I am especially interested in is what is sort of the process by which cases come to the Supreme Court? What ends up sort of determining what their calendar looks like?
Sure. So that is a huge question. I will try to be as concise as I can. So the Supreme Court is in session. There are some breaks in this period, but they are generally in session from early October of every calendar year through roughly the late spring and early summer of the following calendar year. Okay, and so during those times, during those months, they are hearing the cases that they have decided to hear during that term. And that continues through October, November, December, January, February, March, April, May, and sometimes June, but usually June. They're trying to get cases decided so that the justices can go on their summer vacation and travel and do the types of things that they like to do. In terms of how the court decides to hear cases, the vast majority of those cases come to the Supreme Court through after they have made their way over numerous years through the federal court system. So the typical case will begin as a dispute, as most lawsuits begin, as a dispute between two people or a person and the federal government, or and so on and so forth. Okay, and so those people will file a lawsuit in federal district court. One party will lose at the district court. They will then appeal to the United States Circuit Courts of Appeal, okay, which are the sort of intermediate appellate federal courts between the district courts and the Supreme Court. Again, the one of the parties will lose at the Circuit Courts of Appeal, and then if they wish, they can appeal to the United States Supreme Court. The losing party can appeal. They can file with the court what is called a petition for writ of certiorari, or they can, for short, we lawyers call it cert, right? It's a lot easier to say than certiorari. The Supreme Court will then review these thousands and thousands of applications for cert, and they will hold conferences behind closed doors and discuss the different cases and then decide which of these cases they would like to take or they think are worth taking a look at. It's important to understand that the success rate of getting the Supreme Court to hear your case, is incredibly, incredibly low. Like I mentioned just a few moments ago, there are thousands and thousands of petitions for cert that get filed at the Supreme Court every single year. Hmm. And the court grants 50 to 70 of those.
Wow.
Every year, roughly. Now that can fluctuate. That can fluctuate from year to year. This court, the current court has been fairly minimalist in the cases that it's hearing. In the past, though, the court would hear, up to 100 or a little over 100 of cases per term. So it can depend on it depends on a bunch of different things.
Interesting.
How many cases? Yeah.
Yeah. I was just going to say. So that scene that we sometimes see, maybe in a movie or something, and once in a while in real life, where somebody angrily shakes their fist in the air and says, "I'm taking this to the U.S. Supreme Court." Well, maybe you are or maybe you aren't, and most likely you're not. That is, it isn't up to you whether or not the U.S. Supreme Court is going to hear a given case. It is up to them what they will deem to be, in a sense, worthy of their attention. And I'm just curious, when those kind of matters are deliberated, is it your sense that there is a wide divergence of opinion when it comes to that matter of whether or not this is a case that we should be taking up? I mean, I guess another way to ask that is, we hear a lot about the split between conservative and liberal justices when it comes to, what they think about a given case. When it comes to the matter of should we even hear this case, is there a similar sort of breakdown left to right, or are there other factors at play that would influence whether or not the court would choose to hear a case?
Yeah, again, an excellent question. The short answer is we don't exactly know for sure. I'll give you what the justices will say on that question and what I would say. What the justices will say is, no, the conservative liberal divide does not play into which cases the court decides to hear. Just to take a step back here and give some important context, when the court is deciding whether to hear a given case or not, they take a vote on whether, yes, they should hear this case, no, they should not. They need four of the justices to vote affirmatively to hear a case in order to take that case. Okay. One thing you may notice is that there are nine justices on the court. only four of them, so a minority of the justices need to vote yes to hear a case. Returning to your question, my view is that when there is a particularly controversial case that has made its way up to the Supreme Court and the court is deliberating, political views, values of the justices play a not insignificant role in determining how they're going to vote. Okay. So for example, the court, as I'm sure you have heard, overruled Roe versus Wade just a couple of years ago now. When that case was making its way up through the federal courts and the justices were deliberating on it, and they decided, they issued an order saying they were granting cert in this case, in the Dobbs case, it was fairly apparent that they did so, that they granted cert, because they had multiple justices who were willing to say something about the standing of Roe versus Wade. Okay, so we don't know exactly, you know, how these dynamics play out, because again, they are closed doors and the justices will not talk about them in public. But you can glean clues from the context in which the case gets to the court, the subject matter, and so on and so forth.
Hmm. A matter that I hadn't thought of asking you about, something you just said prompts me to ask this question, and that is that matter of the U.S. Supreme Court doing so much of what they do behind closed doors. And of course, for most of its history, those doors were utterly closed. And only at some point in time, and I don't really recall when, once in a while, with especially momentous cases, we would actually be able to hear audio from the U.S. Supreme Court. And of course, I'm sure many of our listeners can recall hearing audio excerpts from their deliberations, mm-hmm. and that can be incredibly dramatic and interesting. I think especially of the case that involved same-sex marriage and a ban of that being overturned, mm-hmm. which of course was a momentous decision in so many ways. And I remember being just riveted to audio excerpts from their deliberations. Do you happen to recall at what point the Supreme Court opened itself up in that respect, and what is open to the public in that way? What level of openness is there with the U.S. Supreme Court?
That's again a great question. I am not entirely sure when the transparency of the court, at least the transparency vis-a-vis the court and the general public, has sort of waxed and waned. Okay. The Supreme Court does indeed for years and years now, as long as the technology, frankly, has been available, has released audio of oral arguments in all of their cases. They also, up until COVID, they would also release audio recordings of announcements of their opinions. And so what would happen there is, you know, when the justices are at a point during their term where they want to or are prepared to issue opinions, they would all file out onto the bench in the Supreme Court, and they would go through the cases they decided for that day, and whoever had the majority opinion would read a brief summary of the opinion and the reasoning, and then occasionally the justices who were the dissenters in that case might read their dissents from the bench. And that has historically been interpreted as marking pretty vehement disagreement with the majority opinion. So you would see this oftentimes in politically contentious cases. That has resumed in the wake of COVID, but given other, there are some other issues that we can get to later on that have sort of made the court a little bit more hesitant to engage in the public eye. They've become a lot more guarded in their public facing dynamic. If that makes sense.
It does. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Pat Zubkowski, who teaches law at Marquette University. And we are talking today on the morning show about the United States Supreme Court, about how it functions, about the most significant cases that it has taken up recently. And we'll certainly touch on a couple of the most important cases that it is likely to be taking on in the coming months. And one or two of them, of course, are of incredible significance. Pat Zubkowski, let's talk first about that matter of recent cases of some significance. And you tell us that actually the way the Supreme Court right now functions, that it does not hear quite so many cases as it once did. But still, I think you quoted a figure of something like 60 or 70 in the course of a calendar year. Is that right? Did I hear that correctly?
Yeah, roughly in that area. Again, there's a little bit of room for maneuvering around the margins there. I don't know right off the top of my head how many cases they have actually agreed to hear for this term, but it may even be less than 60. They may be in the 50s right now, which is a dramatic decrease in their docket from years past.
And ahead of us talking about these recent cases, I think it would be interesting if you would summarize for us the current makeup of the United States Supreme Court and what we see in terms of justices that tilt to the left, tilt to the right versus those who are moderately in the center, what the U.S. Supreme Court in that respect looks like right now.
Sure. So this is a very interesting issue right here. Of course, so what I will do is I'll start with the Chief Justice, John Roberts. Roberts is conservative. He is decidedly to the right of the political spectrum. He worked in the Reagan administration. He has extensive ties to the conservative legal movement that really kind of gained steam during the 70s and especially the 1980s. But tempering that conservatism, or at least in some cases tempering that conservatism, is his role as the Chief Justice of the United States and his fear that the Supreme Court will be viewed as just another wing of, or just another player in partisan politics. So Roberts, with the current composition of the court, sits pretty close to the center. He is very concerned. He definitely has an agenda. He has written some very, very important and contentious opinions for the court during his time since he was appointed as Chief Justice in 2005. But again, he is tempered in how far he is willing to go in certain cases by his concern for the image of the court in the public eye. Next, we can go with Clarence Thomas, who is one of the two most conservative members of the court. He is also the second African-American man to serve on the court. Thomas is a very interesting figure. He grew up in Georgia with in extreme poverty, of course, when he grew up in the 50s and 60s. Georgia was segregated, and so a lot of his life story is about segregation and his response to that. Thomas is appointed to the Supreme Court by George H.W. Bush, the first Bush. And his confirmation hearing is very controversial. A woman who was a former colleague named Anita Hill comes forth and accuses Thomas of sexual harassment, and this embitters Thomas. He is nonetheless confirmed to the court, but he is very, very angry and upset with what he perceives as bad treatment by the Senate and by the public. Thomas is, as I said, maybe the most conservative justice on the court. He is very tied to originalism as a method of constitutional interpretation. Samuel Alito, one of the second most conservative justice on the court, he's appointed in 2005 by George W. Bush along with the Chief Justice, and he is. Alito, basically, you can count as a rubber stamp for the conservative position in most cases. Next up, we have Sonia Sotomayor, who is probably the most liberal. So we're flipping sides of the aisle here. She's appointed by Barack Obama in 2008, and she is... The first Latina to serve on the U.S. Supreme Court. She's very liberal. She had an extensive career as a district attorney in New York City. She served on the federal courts of appeals before she got nominated to the Supreme Court. And so she is the most friendly to progressive issues on the court. Elena Kagan is the next up. She is she's on to the left of center, a little bit more willing to compromise with conservatives than perhaps Sotomayor is, but nonetheless, if there is a contentious issue, Kagan is on to the left of center and is a reliable vote for the quote-unquote liberal or progressive position. She has a unique background. She serves as the dean of Harvard Law School. And then from there, she becomes the Solicitor General of the United States under President Obama. And then from there, after her tenure as Solicitor General, President Obama nominates her to become to the Supreme Court in 2010. The last few here, I'll try to go quickly so that we don't spend too much time. Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh. These are Trump's first two nominees to the Supreme Court. Gorsuch is quite conservative. Like Thomas, he is a proponent of originalism. He is very, I think if I were to characterize his views, he is a libertarian. He is very suspicious of government power. And of the administrative state, which is where I spend a lot of my intellectual capital. And Brett Kavanaugh, who again, like Justice Thomas, his confirmation hearing was incredibly controversial, for similar reasons as Thomas's. Kavanaugh is to the right of center, but he is pretty close to the center of the court. He is fairly, he and Chief Justice Roberts are fairly simpatico on a lot of issues. And like Roberts, Kavanaugh seems to be very, very conscious of public perception of the court. Last two here, the most recent two appointments, Amy Coney Barrett, who is Donald Trump's third and final appointment to the Supreme Court, who of course replaced Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who unfortunately passed just before the 2020 election. Justice Barrett, we really don't know a whole lot about some of her views on a lot of issues. We have an idea. She's decidedly to the right of center, but we really don't know a whole lot about her as of right now. I would say she is somewhere in between Roberts and Kavanaugh and the quite conservative justices who I would characterize as Alito, Thomas, and Gorsuch. Finally, we have Ketanji Brown Jackson, who is President Biden's appointee. She is with in the liberal wing of the court, joining Kagan and Sotomayor. She is the first African-American woman to serve on the Supreme Court. That's a promise that Biden made when he was campaigning for president. Again, similar to Barrett, we don't know a ton about what Jackson's views are on a lot of issues, but by all accounts, she is reliably within the liberal camp of the court. And she is she's the most recent, so that's all nine by my count.
Right. So in terms of its general makeup, we have a court tilted to the conservative, but we have a couple of justices who can kind of flip either way.
Yes and no. This is the most conservative court that we have had in probably close to 100 years. It is a solid 6-3 conservative majority. That being said, there has been a little bit of evidence that Kavanaugh, Barrett, and Roberts are willing to maybe make a little bit more compromise with the liberal justices on some issues. But what we've really seen at the end of the day is in politically contentious cases, that they're not especially willing to do that. But I think that what you suggested is partially right, and that there is a little bit room for compromise, but I would not overstate that capacity.
Right. They are overall a decidedly conservative court.
Absolutely.
With several justices who in certain cases will perhaps tilt unexpectedly, shall we say. We're speaking with Pat Sobkowski about the United States Supreme Court. He teaches law at Marquette University. When we look back over 2023, what would be a couple of the most significant cases that the Supreme Court took up? And in other words, a couple of their most significant decisions during the year just completed.
Yeah, so there are a handful that really stick out. The first ones that I want to talk about are the affirmative action cases. Students for Fair Admission versus Harvard and Students for Fair Admission versus the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. So affirmative action is at the center of these cases. For those of your listeners who don't know, affirmative action generally refers to the idea that we should pay attention to a person's race when admitting them to, among other things, institutions of higher education, universities, colleges, so on and so forth. This has been very contentious throughout really the latter half of the 20th century up until the present day. The court has heard several cases that kind of built up this scaffolding of precedent leading up to the Students for Fair Admissions cases from this past term. But in these two cases, the North Carolina and Harvard cases, the Supreme Court says that the admissions policies employed by North Carolina and Harvard, which do explicitly take race into account when admitting students, violate the 14th Amendment of the Constitution, specifically the Equal Protection Clause and also the Civil Rights Act of 1964. the court really engages in a debate, and it has been engaging in a debate for quite some time, bolstered by scholarship, you know, on both sides of this issue, about whether the Constitution is quote unquote colorblind, or whether there is room for some consideration of race in admissions and higher education. People who believe in this idea of a colorblind constitution say that it is unconstitutional to consider race essentially at all. They argue that racial discrimination is odious. It is really antithetical to the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution, and that stands true whether this is racial discrimination in the way that we would think about it, you know, with Jim Crow or slavery or racism just in general, or if it's beneficial to a group of people, in this instance, admitting them to prestigious colleges because of their race. On the other side of that debate are people in these cases, the three liberal justices, who argue that we need to consider applicants' race in order to remedy past wrongs. Of course, the obvious historical examples of these past wrongs are slavery, Jim Crow, systemic racism, and we need to consider race to remedy the legacies of those and the downstream effects that these families, these minority families, have experienced because of these really shameful periods in American history. There's also an argument that they make that diversity is important as an educational experience, right? We don't want to have only white people in institutions of higher education because we need people to engage from different backgrounds, different ethnicities, different races, different religions, and so we need affirmative action to gain this sort of critical mass of diversity in institutions of higher education. The Supreme Court disagreed with that position, and they held that Harvard and North Carolina's admissions policies are both unconstitutional, and that really casts doubt onto the future of affirmative action in America. It's presumptively unconstitutional now to use race as a determining factor in whether to admit students or applicants to universities or not. A second case that was important were the legal challenges to President Biden's student loan forgiveness program. Mm. The court in those cases, the principal case is called Biden versus Nebraska. Those were legal challenges to Biden's student loan forgiveness program, which would have forgiven up to $20,000 in student loans for households making less than $250,000 a year, or for individuals making less than $125,000 per year. So this is a lot of people on the line, and there's a lot of money at stake. Excuse me, in these cases, it's we're not talking chump change here. We're talking millions and millions of dollars. The Supreme Court said that Biden's student loan forgiveness program was unlawful. In order to understand really the case, it requires getting a little bit into the weeds. I'm not sure if you want to do that or if you would just like me to move on. I'll leave that up to you.
Right.
It can get a little bit complicated.
Yeah, I wish we had a little more time. Maybe just the briefest of summaries of that.
Yeah, so the way that things normally work, when the government wants to do something, when an executive branch agency wants to do something, in this case, it was the Department of Education, they need to be able to point to a statute enacted by Congress that seemingly justifies the action that they want to take. In this case, the Department of Education pointed to a law enacted in the wake of 9/11 in 2003 called the HEROES Act. That law allows the Secretary of Education to waive or modify student loans in a time of war or national emergency. President Biden points to the COVID pandemic, which people lose their jobs, they're not able to keep up with their payments on student loans, and he says, well, look, COVID is a national emergency. This law says that the Secretary of Education can waive or modify student loans, so we are going to waive, you know, these amounts of money of student loans for these qualified individuals. The Supreme Court says that's unlawful. They don't buy the argument. And they do so based on this thing called the major questions doctrine, which says when an agency wants to do something and they're pointing to these federal laws that justify this action, they need to be able to point to clear, explicit text in the statute that would justify that action. And this kicks in, this major questions doctrine kicks in when the action that the government wants to take involves an issue of vast economic and political significance. The court says student loans are, of course, important economically and politically, and so they say there's not sufficient language in the statute to allow this action. And so the court strikes down the student loan forgiveness program. The last one that I'll touch on is a case called 303 Creative versus Alanis. This involved a website designer in Colorado named Lori Smith, who wanted to expand her website business to include wedding websites, but she is a conservative Christian and she did not want to do so for same-sex couples. This put her in direct conflict with a state law that bars discrimination on the basis of, among other things, sexual orientation. And the Supreme Court says that Smith cannot be forced to make websites for same-sex couples because that would violate her rights under the First Amendment. It would, in effect, force her into speech. It would be the government compelling speech in support of something she does not personally support for moral and religious reasons. Significant case because it marks really kind of a push in the conservative direction here, and it really indicates that the court is willing to hear these challenges to anti-discrimination laws based on the First Amendment, among other provisions of the Constitution. So I will stop there. We can continue if you would like, or we can move on to something different.
Right. No, that's all important and it's all significant. I wanted to ask you briefly about another case, United States versus Rahimi, which, if I understand correctly, involves the constitutionality of a law that would ban a person under a domestic violence restraining order from possessing firearms. If I remember correctly, that came to the court maybe late last year. Are you acquainted with that and whether or not a decision has been rendered on that?
Yes. So I just to clarify, the cases that I just discussed were decided last year by the court.
Right.
By the court.
Yes.
So the Rahimi case, yes, I'm familiar with it. It is incredibly controversial. The court heard oral argument in it, in the case, late this past year in late 2023. We do not have a decision on that case, but I'm happy to talk about it. So
Go ahead.
Rahimi, you are correct. Rahimi, you are correct, does involve a man. His name is Zaki Rahimi, who was subject to a domestic violence restraining order in Texas. By all accounts, Rahimi is not a very nice person. The restraining order that he was subject to came about because he assaulted his then-girlfriend, who was also the mother of his child. And then when a witness tried to intervene, well, maybe not intervene, but when there was a witness to the assault and Rahimi fired a gun at the witness. And so he becomes, for obvious reasons, subject to this restraining order. This leads us to the legal issue in the case. There is a federal statute codified as 18 U.S.C. section 922 G8. That law prohibits people like Rahimi, subject to a domestic violence restraining order, from possessing a firearm. The policy considerations here are obvious. We don't want a person who, by all accounts, is a violent person who has, you know, perhaps a partner and children at home to have access to a gun. That's asking for trouble. The Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, which is very conservative, struck down the federal law. They struck down 922 G8. They said that it violates the Second Amendment. That amendment has been interpreted to protect an individual right to own a weapon or a firearm. Supreme Court heard oral argument this past November, and you know, I'm hesitant to offer predictions because things can happen in the meantime. But based on oral argument, the court appears ready to uphold the constitutionality of this federal statute. It's just, when you listen to the justices, they seem to be concerned about this specter of violent individuals having access to a firearm. It's clear that they understand the very real negative implications of protecting a violent person's right to own a handgun. And of course, if people are, you know, convicted of crimes, they can be stripped of certain rights as a matter of course all over areas of the law. So it seems that the court is willing to uphold this federal law that bans people from domestic violence, that bans people who are subject to these types of restraining orders from possessing a firearm. That said, we don't know what's going to happen or what will happen until we have a copy of the court's opinion in the case in front of us. I anticipate that we will have the decision sometime later this spring, maybe into the early summer. It just kind of depends on how quickly the justices are able to deliberate and come to, you know, a consensus and so on and so forth.
Very good. And we should clarify for our listeners that for anyone who has particular interest in this extremely significant case, that via C-SPAN and probably among other outlets, it's possible to listen in on some of the oral arguments presented to the court. You can seek that out via C-SPAN to kind of listen to some of what has been said about this really important case. Pat Zubkowski teaches law at Marquette University. And part two of this conversation, in which Pat Zubkowski looks ahead to significant cases that the Supreme Court is likely to take up in the near future, will be part one of tomorrow's morning show. So tune in to hear the rest of this conversation. It's a minute before 9 o'clock. Thursday on the morning show, Michael Klickner from the Racine Theater Guild. On Friday, an American Experience documentary will be previewed called Nazi Town USA, looking at the phenomenon of widespread fascist organizations within the United States back in the 1920s and 30s. Here's our weather forecast for southeastern Wisconsin and northeastern Illinois. We are under a wind chill advisory until tomorrow morning. Today, sunny and bitterly cold. Our high just one above. Wind chills easily 23 to even 33 below zero. Overnight, a low temperature of 2 below and similar wind chills. Wednesday, partly sunny, but warming to a high of 15 and a similar high on Thursday. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva.